This is Research Spotlight at Cumbria.
I've loved the Lake District since I was a child. My parents used to bring me up here. We used to go potholding and rambling and walking.
In this podcast series, we're profiling our researchers, hearing in detail about their work and the impact this has on wider society.
I saw an opportunity to go and study to do mental health nursing. Applied and got it. Sort of working with or trying to support my mother at the time and learning how to be a mental health nurse. The two things sort of then got me really passionate and interested about mental health, I think. That was the start. I guess my title is Professor Joy Duxbury, so I have sort of a dual role in a sense. I am Professor of Mental Health and have been actually a Professor of Mental Health for a number of years now. I can't actually quite think how many, but certainly 10 plus, if not longer. And I've taken up the role of Director of Research and Knowledge Exchange in the Institute of Health. So obviously I'm tasked to still forge the mental health research agenda, as I always have done, whilst at the University of Cumbria, but also to really support the Institute in capacity building and capability building around research generally, but obviously mental health is definitely going to be one of our key strengths and focuses going forward, and our partners want that to be the case, absolutely.
Because this area of health, not new, but I think it's quite new to come to the university, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure really. I mean, I think from what I can gather, and I'm still sort of gathering intelligence and building relationships at Cumbria, but there are most definitely are pockets of research around mental health and around inequalities. And in fact, before I joined the university this year, they with Cumberland Council, they had already secured, when I say they, the University of Cumbria, a partner with Cumberland Council on something called an HDRC, which is a health determinants research collaboration that's funded by the National Institute of Health Research. And that's just getting going currently, and that's going to be all around really exploring inequalities around the Cumbria region. And of course, mental health is a massive element of that. So that was already in the pipeline and going forward, I think, for us. But there are lots more. And other people have done work at the university that align to mental health. It's sometimes just a little bit difficult to tease out what those alignments are, but it's there. There's no doubt about it. And the interest is huge.
I was just going to say, the interest in mental health in particular, I think, in the last 5-10 years, certainly since COVID, but even before, it was huge.
Yeah.
And I guess, given what you said, you've been involved in mental health in this area for quite some time, I think you said a decade,
yeah.
You know, you must have seen this coming from, you were one of the early adopters. You were already doing the research and looking at this interest, this area,
yeah,
way before other people. So do you feel kind of heartened that there's more interest now than ever?
I am. I suppose I'm heartened and both heartened and terrified in equal proportions, really, because on the one hand, we are at a bit of a crisis point, I think. I'm thinking about the UK particularly, but globally in terms of mental health issues, you know, whether they've come to the forefront because of various things, and you mentioned COVID as one of them, but it seems we are getting to a critical point now where systems are broken and people who are very vulnerable are not getting the care and the support that they need. And clearly research and knowledge exchange has got to be a crucial part of finding ways of, one, filling the gaps, but also putting new things in place that can support people and that are evidence-based. So there's that. But going back to your point about, you know, I must be heartened. There's most definitely, and has been probably for at least 5 years now, a significant funding of mental health research that has risen enormously over the last few years. I remember when what I didn't say is I am a mental health nurse by background. That's how I started. And still I'm on the register, actually, although I don't actively practice anymore. Interestingly, when I started, you couldn't get funding to do research on mental health for love nor money. You really were the poor man's version of things, and it was very difficult. Whereas now, you know, if you apply for funding, you have a chance. And actually, they are putting more and more specific and dedicated calls out around aspects of mental health research. A lot of the funders, dedicated work streams. So that is really heartening to see.
I've just had a flashback from a story I did many, many years ago, and somebody said mental health was a Cinderella service for the NHS.
Yeah.
Is that how what it was like when you were starting out?
I think it is still, and I think a lot of people working in those services would say that. And even those people at senior level, you know, we work with quite a few mental health trusts in the region, and services. And but that said, I think there is a real thirst and a real vision now to make a difference. It's really just the funding and resourcing of it that's still challenging.
And I wonder what led you to go into this area of health, and particularly say you're a mental health nurse. You know, did you have a choice of different specialties? What made you choose that one when you were starting out?
Yeah, that's it's a really interesting question, actually, and I have been asked that before. I never woke up one day and thought, I want to be a mental health nurse, or I'm interested in mental health, quite frankly. And I did what was back then called general nursing, you know, from the age of 17, 18. I trained to be they call them adult nurses now, general nurse. And I did that and thoroughly enjoyed it, actually. But there were no jobs back then at the time in the Northwest region. So I packed my bags and off I went to London. And moved down there and did bits and bobs when I was down there, but just fell into a mental health nursing course. It was almost like there was nothing else to do, so I'll do this. But that said, it coincided at a time when my mother was very seriously ill with mental health problems, and I don't think myself and my father at that point had ever quite realised, one, how ill she was, or that it was a serious mental health problem. And so the two worlds sort of aligned. I saw a call, I saw an opportunity to go and study to do mental health nursing, applied and got it. And as I say, sort of working with or trying to support my mother at the time and learning how to be a mental health nurse, the two things sort of then got me really passionate and interested about mental health. I think that was the start. So that was way back. You know, as I say, I was probably in my mid-20s at that point. So I've obviously been doing mental health now for a long, long time, and I've thoroughly enjoyed, really, you know, championing it and carrying on in that field. I sort of rose through the ranks in nursing quite quickly at that time. So I went from being qualified as a mental health nurse, became what they call a staff nurse, worked in a hospital down in Surrey, actually, that was quite a contained unit. We were quite a family, and became a ward sister quite quickly. But my passion was always around the sort of high end of psychiatry, so people who had very complex needs, and they worked in. So I worked in an area called PICU, which is psychiatric intensive care units, and did some work in forensic services as well back then, and always found it just really interesting, but very, as you rightly said, quite a difficult area to work in. And I think you get, and I'm sure staff would say this today, you can get burnt out very quickly, because you are in very intense situations on a daily basis. But what it did teach me was that even back then, and I probably wasn't practicing for that long, actually, in the greater scheme of things, I just remember thinking, we need to do something different here. You know, both the systems and the environments weren't that great, and many would say still aren't today. And in fact, very early on, I thought, it feels to me like we're actually re-traumatising people, rather than actually, you know, they're not the havens that they're meant to be. They're certainly not the therapeutic havens that they're meant to be. And that started sparking an area of interest for me, I think, about how can we do this differently. And I think that's when I started thinking, well, I wonder what's been written about this. I wonder, is there any research in this area? And I guess, as they say, the rest is history. I started looking at that and then thought about doing my PhD, and then the sort of world opened up for me. But interestingly, I got very into, some people may or may not be familiar with the work of Goffman. There's a guy called Goffman that wrote a lot of stuff way back in the 50s and 60s about asylums, institutional asylums. And, you know, people still quote him today, and lots of the aspects that he talked about back then, you know, a really, really echo for a lot of people today about the challenges that we've got still with our institutions and how we manage them. I've been one of those people that in a way had been quite lucky in life, that I've just fallen into opportunities. They've just seemed to have presented themselves, and I've run with them. So again, interestingly, when I did my when I was a ward sister and was doing my mental health nursing, Because back then when I did my training, because I'm getting on a bit now, you know, we didn't do degrees or even diplomas at that time. There were certificated courses, and I sort of got interested. I'd always sort of thought I'd like to go and study at degree level. And again, when I was a ward sister, it was just quite, again, so opportunistic. We had some students from Northern Ireland who came to visit and spend time as interns on our ward, who were actually doing a nursing degree in Northern Ireland at Coleraine University. And I got chatting to them and got quite, because I used to do a bit of teaching at the local nursing school and always enjoyed the educational side of things. And they told me that they were at that point being funded to do a degree. They'd applied for a scholarship, got the award. So I looked into that scholarship, and there were three universities in the UK that did this particular scholarship for nurses to do a degree. And anyway, I applied and got one, strangely, which surprised me no end. And so my option, I could have gone to Cardiff or Hull or Coleraine. And anyway, I went to Hull University. And so left my sister's position altogether and went and did a full-time degree at Hull University. And it was just a game changer, absolute game changer. I learned, actually, I had some intelligence that I tapped into that I didn't know was there, quite frankly, because I'd never done very well at school. And it just opened up a whole world of intrigue and interest and a thirst for learning. And then, of course, then once I'd done my degree, and that was full-time, and it was fully funded, so I wasn't, you know, I didn't need to be worried about money at that time. But then it then gave me a thirst to carry on in higher education, and then that's what I did. And interestingly enough, when I left Hull University, obviously I was jobless at that point, so having been a full-time student, I was looking to move back to Lancashire, which is sort of where my family were. A job was being advertised for a sort of an interim lecturer to fill in for somebody who was on maternity leave. And lo and behold, it was at what was called then St. Martin's College in Lancaster, which of course now is the University of Cumbria. So how weird is that? That was my first
small world
lecturing higher education position at St. Martin's College. And wow. I was there for about 3 years. And I've come full circle. Knowledge is power, and I think, again, I've learned that over the years, because we can get stuck in asking questions that might have one already been answered, and if we look out to the research field and to the literature, we can find those answers, but we can also find people to work with who can help us not only understand things but learn from what they've done, and does that apply to us? And that can be both national and international. And that certainly is what's been hugely important for me, is around networking, and has made such a difference to my opportunities and career, I think. And hopefully the impact that I've had over the years is just finding other people through the research or through the literature. When I did my PhD, I was very fortunate that one of my PhD examiners was quite networked in with a European group around the very area that I was looking at, and sort of said to me, you ought to join this group. And I'm very grateful to him for that. And I did join that research, the European Research Group, and got me involved with, you know, with that group is still going as we speak. And I actually became the chair of that group for several years at one point. So it's funny how I became a very junior, early career researcher, really actually like a rabbit in the headlights, going to some of those meetings and thinking all these big names in the room were people I'd read about. It was a bit like seeing your sort of hero, so to speak, and then becoming quite an influential person in that group. But it was through that of getting, it's funny, I had a conversation with some people recently at Cumbria Uni. I got a group of people together to look at, we're trying to develop mental health research in a more structured way, and I'm galvanising the people now, I'm now learning, who have an interest in it. And we had a meeting yesterday, our first meeting, to start saying, who are we, what do we want to do, and what do we want to be famous for, so to speak. And I just said, really, you know, we need to see this as our gang, our clan, a sense of belonging, because I think as researchers, you're very right, and research can be very lonely. And I think that's what I found when I did my PhD, until I got involved with this group of other researchers. I did a few publications and was just squirreling away, writing papers on my own, and not feeling I was making much of a difference, but unbeknown to me, people actually were reading those papers and getting in touch with me. But yeah, it can be lonely, and I think it really is important for people to work with other people and find those people, yeah, you know, to get that sense of belonging and make a better impact.
I think, have you got a name for your group, by the way, Cumbrian Group? Or are you just racking in bread?
No, not yet. No, we're still at the early stages, but clearly mental health research is very high on our agenda.
Yeah.
And that, as I say, there was a group of about 10 of us having a general conversation about how do we want to move forward and what do we want to be and what will we look like.
That's brilliant. That's exciting, isn't it, as well, given that you've come into an area, you're still finding your feet, and starting in at the start is always exciting, isn't it? Because you can make it run whichever direction you want to go. So that sounds really
good.
But
in mental health research, I mean, the opportunities are vast in a location like this. And again, I've had conversations with people who obviously know Cumbria better than me. But when you look at the landscape, it's a real, I'm trying to think what the word is, it's like a dichotomy. You know, on the one hand, you have people from all over the world that want to come to Cumbria because of the landscape. It's beautiful. We've got various Michelin star restaurants dotted around the place. I believe in the UK we've got more in Cumbria than anywhere. And yet there are terrible inequalities, and you start unpicking around the region that maybe aren't as obvious. And that is something that we really want to look at. And mental health is a massive aspect of that. You know, so that there are definite areas for us that we want to look at children and young people, for example, because again, if they get on the wrong trajectory, you know, their mental health gets affected very early on, and then they can have a life of misery if that's not addressed or if they're not supported early on. So that's one area. The whole area around crisis and urgent and emergency care, and again, because of the rurality in many instances, is a big issue for Cumbria, for the Cumbria population and for residents, and for services as well, actually. And the other thing about well-being and the use of outdoors and green space, you know, we know, and that's why lots of people come up here, because they love to go walking. I mean, I have two dogs, I go walking regularly, and it really does lift your spirits, even if it is, as you said, if it's raining like today. Took my dogs out this morning and got soaking wet and was muttering away to myself about it. But then you look at the landscape and you can't really be miserable. And it really does uplift your spirits.
Yeah.
And again, I mentioned to you before we started, you know, that there are charities like Growing Well, which really use horticulture to support people who are not getting that much support in the community or through services to help them better their mental health through growing things. There are lots of things we already know that we can do at Cumbria. One, because of some of the critical mass we've got already, but because of the partners that we know we can work with, and indeed the landscape.
And I guess for students listening to this who might be thinking of coming to Cumbria in future years, what a great place to come because, of, as you just said very well, the variety, the challenges, and there are challenges in Cumbria, but also the opportunities, because there are many. And you've already hinted that this organisation's quite newly formed, although growing well, 25 years old this year as we're talking, you know. But there are lots of opportunities, I think, somebody who lives and works around here aren't being taken up, and yet with a few people working together, collaborating, that the C word again, the difference that could be made, I think, is huge. And it's exciting, not just for Cumbria, but for the rest of the country and potentially internationally as well.
Yeah. And the lovely thing about Cumbria that I've learnt, and in fact lots of people have commented on that, is that the partnership working is pretty amazing, actually. Having come from other areas where we used to have to sort of be constantly fighting to get partners to work with us, they're sort of knocking on our door of, you know, we want to work with the University of Cumbria, we want to do more with you, you're our university. And that's amazing to see and to hear without having to sort of seek it out yourself.
So you said before you were heartened, but also I think you said slightly a bit of trepidation about the amount of work.
Yeah. Just because it's a big, you know, there's a lot to do. And there are so many, I think, things that can or could be tackled around mental health.
Is there any particular aspects of mental health that you're interested in you know, it's such a wide church, be a broad church, isn't it, as they say, but when it comes to sort of a certain part of mental health, is there one area specifically that you find interesting?
Well, there is for me. I mean, obviously in the role I've got now, I you know, there's two aspects to the role as Director of Research and Knowledge Exchange, is that one, I'm here to support and develop other people in their areas of interest and how we move forward in that. But clearly, I mean, I've been at this a long time now, from way back when I did my PhD. You know, the area of interest then has carried on. It's always quite difficult to describe because it's so niche. And I often say to people, I have a very unhealthy preoccupation with exploring aspects and avenues around death. And I need to sort of explain that slightly. Again, and this goes back to when I was a ward sister, I've always felt that the environments that people find themselves in, so much of my work has, one, been around the adult population, and two, has been around people with complex needs who are institutionalised in whatever form that might take. So that's sort of my niche area. But the very niche aspect of that has been really looking at the trauma that they come with, and then, you know, that gets exacerbated by the surroundings and what happens to them, and then how they respond to that. Now, classically, I guess what I've published a lot around is something that we now call restrictive interventions, coercive practices. So again, sadly, for many, many years, organisations that deal with people that have mental health problems have had a very unhelpful preoccupation with really trying to manage what's perceived as difficult behaviour. I constantly remind people now to refer to it in a more relational way as conflict. You know, whenever somebody is expressing themselves and showing their distress, there is normally a reason for that. Mm. They don't just do it for the sake of it. There might be a very, very small proportion of people that like, for whatever reason, to inflict harm on others. But generally speaking, people often come from a very traumatic space. Mm. And, you know, for various reasons, can find it quite difficult to articulate their needs. And that might come out in a way that then presents itself that is hard for staff to manage. And I'm all about prevention. What we've done in inpatient psychiatry, particularly for many years, is sort of been very reactive. And I saw this when I was trained and when I was working in services. We sort of used to wait for things to get to a critical point and then we'd intervene. And unfortunately, that meant that very invasive procedures like restraint, like seclusion, there are things called long-term segregation now that we've seen in this country, which I could bore you for hours about, that are really sort of problematic. There's been a big review done of it recently. And something called rapid tranquilisation or medicating people against their will. And as you can imagine, all of these things are very distressing, not only for the patients involved, but for the staff. It's not a nice thing to have to do to individuals who are already there because they're mentally distressed in some capacity. So to isolate them in a locked room, to over-medicate them, to restrain them, is very damaging therapeutically all round. And then you end up with a cohort of people that get even more distressed. Their stays in hospital get more prolonged. And actually, it's very costly to the NHS. And if we could just be mindful of the journey that people have been on, but what they, you know, from the minute they come through those doors, what are we doing to support and help them? And indeed, welcome them. There's an awful lot, and that sounds very simplistic, doesn't it? Sounds like teaching people to suck eggs. You would think people would do that anyway.
It does sound obvious, but I'm guessing from the tone and what you've told me before that it's still not happening today. Yeah. But it probably needs to happen now. Otherwise, we can't afford to carry on the working the way we're working. Can we? With the NHS, something's got to change. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe preemptive work or early intervention is the answer. But how you achieve that, I guess, is the research doing.
Well, absolutely, and that's, in a way, I mean, it's been great for me to see how some of the early seeds have developed into what's happened now nationally and internationally, and not just because of me, but because of the people I work with. In some ways, we are in a different space, and things are more positive. And I can explain to you a little bit more about how the impact has sort of, what trajectory that has taken. But there's still a lot to do, and we still are seeing, you know, sadly, quite frequently, exposés nationally. You see things on BBC Panorama. You see a lot, actually, far more than I would care to see, both with people with mental health problems and also people with learning disabilities and or autistic people who are often placed in very inappropriate settings with staff that don't understand them or don't know how to care for them, not because of their own faults, but because there are just challenges to where people can get placed in terms of resources. But my God, there's a lot of work gone on over the last few years. And going back to working with people and networking, I have been very lucky in a sense that having gone from the European network that I mentioned to you that I'm still involved in, we set up a charity in the UK called the Restraint Reduction Network. I didn't set that up, but I've been heavily involved in it and its trajectory, and we've been going for quite some time now. And it's a community of practice in a sense, but it's also a charity that's had huge influence over the years in talking to policymakers, in getting mandatory training standards rolled out across the whole of the country, actually, of getting laws changed around some of these things with the people and the trustees that we work with, addressing inequalities. We have a yearly conference addressing all of these things where we have people from all over the world come to share their experiences. There's a massive commitment now to make change and to make environments better places for people so that they're not constantly being re-traumatised. So there are lots of initiatives going on, lots of people working on this, and a lot of research actually has gone on.
So from what you're saying, it's very timely then to launch this network you mentioned before locally, but also for the University of Cumbria to perhaps take a more high-profile role, should we say, in being seen to be the place that can get things done. You said before, people coming to collaborate willingly to get involved.
Yeah. I mean, that's only my niche area in a sense, you know, and it's very much around changing institutional cultures and organisational change. I do a lot of work around, and I've done a lot of research around organisational needs and the sorts of approaches that you can use to make those significant changes. Talking to local trusts about this recently, actually, we're very interested, who know about all of this stuff, but I'm quite glad that I've joined Cumbria, because we can sort of really get our teeth into embedding some of the research into practice.
Interesting times, and a good time to come. You're going to be very busy, and I'm sure you've certainly made your parents very proud of what you've done from way, way back as well. But what do you think is your biggest achievement so far? We're talking as we are now, and obviously lots coming up, but what is the one thing perhaps you could say that, you know, has really made you feel proud and kept you going perhaps when there were times to do something else?
I think the thing that was quite a shock to me and that I am most proud of is that, and it was during COVID actually, I was awarded an OBE. You know, that was a surprise to me. In fact, because it was during COVID, I believe you would normally get a letter through the post, a very official-looking letter. So I actually got an email telling me I'd got a Queen's Honour in, I think it was the New Year's honours period, and sort of didn't quite believe what I was seeing in the email and assumed it was some sort of junk mail or or joke of some description. So for me, the recognition that, oh gosh, people do value me. Somebody somewhere has valued me sufficiently to put the time and effort into nominating me. You know, that's important. And of course it helps because, you know, it helps, I think, move things forward in terms of how you can get further engaged, particularly at policy level, if people see that recognition.
At the end of the day, it's a job, it's a tough job, it's a tough area of research. I wonder what keeps you going, you know, why do you still want to make a difference? Why are you move to Cumbria, setting up this new network? What still fires you? Why still the ambition?
It's interesting, isn't it? Why do we keep going? You know, because I must admit, I sort of recently was at a crossroads of, you know, is it time to hang my hat up and just walk my dogs more, do a bit of travelling? You know, do the things I'm passionate about, like carrying on with my trustee roles and those things, and carry on with the impact and anything I can support and help with in that regard. But I don't know, I'm not ready. I keep having that conversation with myself, probably on a weekly basis. I don't know, there's work to be done still. And this role, I think, is very different for me now, because even though I have developed people in previous roles and supported people who were, you know, brought people up the ranks, who, you know, who have got more senior roles themselves now, that I've mentored. This is a much bigger strategic position about trying to really support Cumbria University and, you know, indeed the Institute of Health, of really raising the profile of research for us, not just around mental health, but obviously mental health would be a key priority for us. So at the moment, it feels like, yeah, it's the next step. Be great to get things moving. Be great. I mean, it'd be great to be able to leave some sort of legacy, I think. We have great researchers at Cumbria University, and what I've learnt is that, one, not only is there a passion, but there is a real thirst. A lot of things, you know, even though we're quite diverse in some respects of the things that we do across the whole university, the researchers I'm talking about now, there is a real commonality in values and in involving people. As I say, we're all invested in co-creation, co-production. I've learnt that. It's not just something I'm interested in. There's lots of professors and assistant professors, associate professors, and other researchers that are equally as interested in that, and in really pushing that agenda and how we move it forward so that it's impactful and it's meaningful to those. You're not just doing research on people, you're doing research with people. So, I mean, I think if people want to learn about those sorts of things or be involved in that, this is a great place for them to come.
I've got one last question. It's the question that people always kind of worry about, and it's this. So as we conclude our conversation about research, can you perhaps choose one word that describes the kind of person you are? Previous guests on this podcast have gone for things like ambitious, stoical was one of your colleagues, but they chose that word. What about you, to pin you down to one word? Is there just the one word you could think about that would summarise either what you've done or maybe what you hope to achieve?
It's always hard with these things, isn't it? Because there's always an immodesty to trying to find a word, unless if you were saying that you were stroppy or challenging or whatever.
Some people might say that. Funny enough, but yeah. No.
I think I'm curious. I think I have a real curiosity, and increasingly so, not just in finding answers, but in people. I think I am curious.
I'd have said curious or determined. That was the word I thought you might go for, but curious is a great word.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation. I wish you all the best with the new post still, and also this group that you have in mind to try and make a difference for Cumbria. How soon do you think before you hope to make the first seeds, perhaps?
We're already got going on a number of smaller research themes groups currently. There are groups of people that I've already brought together who are starting to sort of think about what we might do going forward and what we're good at and where our synergies and interests lie. So that's happening as we speak. But we probably have a launch of who we are and what we're about, I suspect, early next year.
I bet you can't wait.
Yeah, absolutely. Want to get going.
Professor Dutchby, thanks very much for your time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for downloading this edition of Research Spotlight at Cumbria. Be sure to subscribe and spread the word.